Hello and welcome to the Woodard Report podcast, where we enrich businesses through business advisors. This podcast is your source for information and news you need for your accounting, bookkeeping, or tax practice, and it is proudly sponsored by Expensify and Rightworks. For more information about both Expensify and Rightworks, please visit woodard.com/podcast. And now your hosts, Joe Woodard and Heather Satterley.
Well, Heather, we're back again, and it's always great to be with you. I understand you have a very relevant topic teed up for us about a compliance issue, or maybe not a compliance issue. We have to figure this whole thing out. It's somebody's compliance issue, and you're going to try to brainstorm a little bit about whether it's ours or not, but it's good to be with you here, Heather.
Oh, boy.
Oh, no, you didn't. Okay, now that's, if you're not getting the joke here, you didn't read the title. That was funny. That was funny. And you'll see why in just a minute with boy. But after Heather talks about the boy she's going to talk about and the oh boy factors of it, we're going to have our normal television quote clips. I always bring one. Heather sometimes does. She's got one teed up today. I'm excited to hear about it. I've got a book that I've read recently. I'm going to break down for you. We have our favorite tweets of the day, and Heather's going to end with her favorite Woodard Report article of the week. All right, Heather, what do you mean by oh boy?
Okay. Oh boy. Yeah. So we, you know, everybody's already should be aware of this. If you're not, now you will be aware of it. We have a new compliance reporting requirement for businesses, which is BOI, which is beneficial ownership information, hence the boy joke at the beginning for businesses. So it is meant to enhance transparency for businesses. And they're basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to cut down or stop, intercept illicit activities where people are doing things like money laundering or supporting terrorist activities. So as of January 1st, 2024, the Corporate Transparency Act went into effect. And so any new business that is registering with their Secretary of State or in some cases, other organizations that they have to register are non very highly regulated types of businesses like publicly traded organizations. They all have to file within 90 days in 2024 with FinCEN. So it's not an IRS regulation. We're not filing taxes here. We're actually reporting to FinCEN. So I was just going to go over real quick, just some quick data points today on what do accountants need to know? I mean, the conversations that we've been hearing, Joe, are accountants, are we supposed to be advising our clients about BOI? We're certainly advising businesses about it, so we need to be aware of it. But what are our responsibilities as accountants? And, you know, specifically, there are some requirements for CPAs, and we need to be thinking about our risks on whether or not we actually want to offer services through our practice to help clients file this BOI form and stay compliant. Or is it something that we want to step back and say, no, we'll let them know that it exists, but we'll refer this type of work to someone else.
And there are pros and cons on both sides of that, right?
Yes.
And lots of implications I'm sure you'll break down for us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. So let's go through the basics. We'll go through the basics today. So who has to file? It's really corporations, LLCs, anybody that is filing with the Secretary of State. Is required to file a beneficial ownership information report. There are 23 categories of exemptions for this, so it's not something where it is pretty intricate, and you do need to do your homework. I am not going to go through all 23 categories of exemptions on our podcast. That would be a very boring podcast, in my opinion. But I will break out the main ones. And I'm getting my information. I'm part of the AICPA tax section, and they have an incredible dashboard built out for our tax professionals that really breaks this down and gives you one place to go to really understand what's happening with this new legislation and what our requirements are as accounting professionals. So the main ones that I'm going to point out are publicly traded companies are not required to file it. Banks and credit unions, securities brokers and dealers, public accounting firms, we don't have to file that because we're regulated. Tax exempt entities are exempt, and large operating entities, which include folks or businesses that employ over 20 people in the United States, have reported gross revenue of over $5 million on their prior year's tax return. So that would be 2023, because we're in 2024, and that they're physically present in the U.S. So those are just the kind of big ones.
I've got some follow-up questions for you here. First, by public accounting firms, you mean actual CPA firms, right?
Public accounting firms, as defined by the AICPA.
Which means that you have, that you're a CPA firm.
Right, because you'd be governed by the Board of Accountancy in the state, which means that you are regulated.
Exactly. Right? So I just want to make sure we're clear on that, that enrolled agent practices are not exempt.
That's correct.
Okay, and
actually, I'm going to back up. An enrolled agent practice, I do not believe would be exempt.
That's what I'm saying. I don't believe they are, because they're not governed by a state board of accountancy.
They are not governed by.
They are governed by, but they're credentialed by the IRS, but there's no oversight there.
Right.
So we can drill down on that and get a definitive answer. But my understanding is EAs are not exempt.
They're not exempt.
And definitely non-credentialed CAS practices. So just want to make sure, because the term public accounting firm can be perceived by many people to be a lot of things. So if you're governed by your state board of accountancy or the SCPA, then that's the idea. You already have oversight. Now, this is what I find interesting. I can see that there's oversight in publicly traded companies inherent in that. Financial institutions, absolutely. And security brokers and dealers, yes. But there are institutions that provide oversight into other industries. And I know we don't have all the exempt list here and what you've mentioned. So maybe that they are covered there. However, this large firm thing is intriguing to me, or large company thing is intriguing to me, because if the goal is to provide greater oversight and accountability for maybe the laundering of money and for terrorists and other activities, you know, that's not that big of a company. That's my size company, and I would consider myself to be a small business, right? Mm-hmm. And that might be the very qualifier to say, hey, this business is doing enough money that they could theoretically successfully launder money without getting caught. I mean, if you watch Breaking Bad, that car wash had 20 employees and probably did over $5 million in sales, and that's where he laundered all his money. And that was a fictional story, but that made the story realistic. If he'd gone into a very tiny business, he couldn't have actually been effective in his activity. So that's the one that's weird to me.
I mean, the whole thing is kind of weird to me, right? Yeah. Like I, you know, when I'm looking at it, and the AICPA agrees. So on February 15th of this year, they sent an open letter, right? Asking, please suspend this. Get rid of this rule.
Maybe can think about it better.
Yeah. Let's just stop with this madness and kind of think a little bit, you know, further through what this actually is going to do to businesses. So we'll have to wait and see how they respond to that. But it is. And honestly, you know, the penalties are not small.
No, right? I mean, hundreds of dollars a day.
Exactly.
Well, and have you seen any commentary, maybe the ICPA has commented on this too, that every business has to have a license with their local jurisdiction to operate as a business. Right. There's already a registration process and there's already an accountability process. And many, many years ago, I had hired sort of the wrong bookkeeper in my business, the wrong back office worker, and she didn't get the business license filed. Boy, those people come knock on your door and they put a sticker on you. You have to stop doing business unless you can get this piece of paperwork filed. And, you know, shame on me for missing it. I'm the owner of business, so it ultimately fell on me, but I was making a point from many, many years ago that there's already a level of accountability here. Right?
There is, absolutely. And I mean, you're right. Even in your town, like you said, you have to file with your town. Why not just have the towns report that
information? Report it up.
Exactly.
And then I'm also registered with Georgia Secretary of State.
Right. Right.
You know, so, and everybody has to file their for the taxes, even if you're a disregarded entity, it shows up on your 1040. So I just don't understand why we need, and I guess that's kind of the theme of the day is, and we're agreeing with AICPA, just, hey, hold on, maybe this isn't needed.
Well, the only thing I can think is that they were trying to take the burden off the states for that reporting requirement, right? And put it on to the actual businesses, which doesn't make a ton of sense. So, I mean, the whole thing
is already on us. We still have to fill out all those paperwork.
Exactly. So now we just have to fill out. And the form is not small. Yeah. You know, at first it looked like it was going to be small. They were like, we want the name, address, and, you know, other information, identifying information of, you know, the owners of the company and the people that are substantially involved, right? So, but it is quite a bit of information that has to be filed. And you can find those forms online. There's an online form that if you want to go through and take a look at it. And there's lots of webinars. There was a webinar on CPA Academy. They're doing BOI webinars. CorpNet is a company that's doing, they're offering that as a service. And I think that's a way for us as accounting professionals, if we don't want to dip our toe into this service, actually partnering with a partner like that can help us to bring that service to our clients without actually us exposing ourselves to the risk. One thing that I do think is really important to understand is, and I thought this was really, really, you know, something very important, is that in the AICPA, they were talking about you know, what are the risks of providing BOI services to your clients? And anytime we do services, we have a risk, right? So we have professional liability insurance for that. Now, the AICPA's member insurance program, they do cover BOI. Other insurance companies may not. I know of at least one CPA that I know personally who reached out to their insurance company and it is not covered, or it wasn't covered the last time I spoke to them. So,
The insurance companies, some of them are taking the position they're not covering it because it's legal services.
And that's something that the AICPA has also now brought to light, is they're saying it's not.
It's not. But the insurance companies aren't listening because it's just a statement by the chairperson of the AICPA. They haven't actually declared something that the insurance companies can get there. They consider it to be an opinion of AICPA
that's
leadership
exactly right.
Because everything's just so premature. Yeah.
Exactly. It wasn't fully baked before they rolled it out, which is what happens. I mean, that's that's one of the reasons that accounting professionals are so resilient. You know, when they say that we need to learn how to adapt to change, I mean, what profession adapts to change more
faster than we do?
Right?
Exactly.
It's a constantly moving target.
Yeah.
So
right now we're adapting to some last minute retroactive tax changes. I mean, we know how to dodge these bullets, right?
We do.
But now here's another bullet we have to dodge. So you have several things that you're wanting to kind of break out on this before we run out of time. And I know I've been extra conversational with you, so I'm just going to let you kind of finish it out.
Great conversation. So what I want to talk about is the AICPA. You know, what they're saying is that right now it looks like it's not practice of law, but of course they always have that disclaimer. You need to check with your state. So the state is the one that's going to say this is the practice of law and only attorneys can actually be delivering the service. That has not happened in any state at this point from my research that I have done. So what they're saying was, and it was really interesting, that on one end, CPAs, you know, should, and this is the bottom line, should be making their clients aware of the requirement to file, right? So we are at a minimum, a CPA is required to make sure that their clients are aware of this regulation and let them know whether they think they are required to file based on, you know, the entity types that have to file and the exemptions. So at a minimum, if you are a CPA, you need to understand what those 23 exemptions are and be able to guide your client on, do you need to file this? Or you need to say you could need to file this and refer them to a service that can help them through the process. At least, and the best practices that they're saying is a letter. There should be a letter that's sent to your client base that outlines high level what the requirements are, where they can find more information. And then you need to make sure that you're documenting any conversations that you're having with your client about the BOI. So at a minimum, that's what we need to be doing. And if we do not, if we don't at least make them aware of it, we could, you know, be accountable. They're saying accountable for the client's non-compliance if we did not tell them that the need existed or potentially existed for them to file this form. So at the end of the day, I think that's the big thing that we need. And that's for CPAs. That does not extend to, you know, CAS practices that are non-credentialed. But
we may have a liability just by errors and omissions or perceived errors and omissions.
Right. Yes. That is correct. But
and my attorney told me once, and this will be staggered. I mean, if you're a non-credentialed practice in here, standalone CAS practice in here, and you're thinking, okay, well, I'll just let everybody else worry about this because I'm not governed and I'm not credentialed. My attorney told me something that transcends this, but applies to this. And it's very sobering. He said, anybody can sue anybody about anything at any time. And then he went further. We were sitting in this restaurant. He said, say the person walking down the street right now, I could sue them. All I have to know is their name and first name, last name, and their address, and I could sue them. Now, might I get also countersued for malicious litigation? Sure. But anybody can sue anybody at any time for any reason in the United States of America. So if the client even perceives that, you were the one that was supposed to tell them, and now they're facing these hundreds of dollars per day or even imprisonment, right, which is one of the outcomes of this thing. I mean, those are triggers for people to do extreme things, and they start lashing out and grasping at everything around them, including you. So Heather, listen, if you don't catch anything else, everybody listening in, put something in writing that states, yeah, if you are or are not going to do this, and if you are going to do it, what the parameters are. And then talk to your professional insurance company.
And the professional insurance companies, they should have a letter that you can use to modify in your practice. So I belong to the AICPA tax section. And so there's a letter that I can use because I pay dues and part of that. And the insurance companies should have a letter that you can leverage for that. So you definitely want to act. Especially new clients, you're getting new clients on, they have 90 days to file this, right, in 2024. So if you're bringing on a new, brand new company, you need to make them aware of this.
So and that's 90 days from January 1st or the date that this went into effect?
Great question, Joe. It's 90 days from the creation of the entity. So I file on the Secretary of State, an incorporation or LLC formation. I have 90 days from that day to file.
So pre-existent companies then have 90 days from the date this went into effect?
No. So thank you for keeping me accountable, Joe. That's why I love you. One of the reasons I love you is new entities in 2024 must file within 90 days. New entities that are registered after 12/31/2024, they have 30 days. So they're giving a little bit of a grace period this year. Next year, it's 30 days. Existing entities, right, which is you and me, anything created or registered before January 1st, 2024, we have to file by January 1st, 2025. So we have a whole year. However, reporting companies that, you know, have changes to previously recorded information. So I file today my BOI and then I move, right? Or ownership changes. I have 30 days to file an update. So if you have partnerships or, you know, LLCs that are acting as partnerships that have a lot of changes in ownership, this can actually be a huge burden on your company, mm-hmm, right? So yes, just something to keep it. And
how do they define ownership? Because I'm on the cap table for several technology startups. And when I exercise those options, am I an owner? So, or do you have to actually... Yes, yeah. Or you have to actually be a managing owner. So, and see, some of these things are the things, the reason the ICPA is going, well, there are so many unanswered questions. It's a lot of fine print here. And there's also a curve where, you know, institutions that manage or regulate the legal industry and the accounting industry, they need runway. And 90 days is not enough runway to train these professionals in how to manage this process.
Right.
It's highly disruptive.
It is highly disruptive.
And in my opinion, it's superfluous.
I agree. I mean, assuming they don't throw it out, we're planning to have a session on this at Scaling New Heights. So mm-hmm. If you're looking to to learn the, you know, the get set in the right direction. Because honestly, I think that it's more than just looking at one session. You really have to dig into this. There's a lot here.
So, yes, there's a lot here. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that we're taking an educational approach to it. I know you manage all those breakouts. I figured you'd be on top of it. And then if for some reason they rescind this, then you just have an open spot. You can put something That's else right. there.
Exactly right. And I hope they do. I hope they do too.
I hope they do too. I hope they just let the process that's already in place start rolling it up. The counties report to the states report to the government, the federal. They use what already we are reporting to the IRS with tax filings. There's enough information there they can just aggregate together without creating yet another regulation. All right. So thank you for bringing this to our attention. Anything else we need to know about it before we move on?
I think that's good. I mean, just do your due diligence, you know, and yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. So this is one of my favorite moments in our podcast because I'm a big TV buff, big movie buff. I know you are too. As a matter of fact, the show, a little spoiler alert, I'm not going to say which one it is that Heather's going to quote here, is one that she recommended I start watching. And it is really, really good if you're a geek. It's got you have to be pretty hardcore science fiction nerd if you're going to watch it. But it's got a lot of interesting takes to it. So normally I'm the only one that does this, but you brought one with us. I'm going to start and then I'm going to let you share yours. So mine comes from the movie Blackberry, which I just got around to watching. I don't believe it came out recently here. I think it was a few years ago. And the CEO of BlackBerry, who is not one of the founders, he was a hired gun from corporate America. The CEO is talking to the founder, and the CEO gives the founder the famous "perfection is the enemy of the good" quote. And it was because the founder did not want to have the phones built in China. He wanted to control the manufacturing process more tightly. He wanted to build something that was extremely high quality, and he didn't feel like that he had the ability to deliver that with overseas labor. Apple does. They have a very high quality product using overseas labor, but he wasn't in a position to do that. And so he was challenging back and saying it's worth having a more expensive phone, maybe even a little bit lower profit to maintain our quality levels. To which the CEO said, "Perfection is the enemy of the good." And I love the founder of BlackBerry's quote back. He says, "But good enough is the enemy of humanity." Now, that's a famous quote from him that they infused into the movie, that good enough is the enemy of humanity. And so what I wrote down here is my big takeaway from this is, you know, between perfection and good enough, right? Because perfection is also crippling. Good enough is mediocrity. There's this thing called excellence. And Disney Institute, and I think we could all agree here that when you go to a Disney park, you're going to receive an expectation and also a consistent delivery of excellence, right? You will not receive perfection, right? And you're not going to receive good enough. You're going to receive excellence. So they found this thing in the middle Disney has. So when Disney Institute was talking about what they do to manage to this outcome, they say that they overpromise and then they overdeliver. I think that's kind of interesting too. It's a neat twist on it, right? Because everybody expects the old cliche, but they overpromise and then they overdeliver. But here's the key. They do not measure their overdelivery in perfection. They measure their overdelivery in consistency.
Ooh.
Consistency is the connective thread between perfectionism and mediocrity. Consistent goodness.
Love it.
All right. So what do you bring?
All right. My gosh, I love the show. It's so good. I've been binging.
You mean our podcast or the one you're watching?
No, I'm sorry. I love this show, but yeah, the one I'm going to drop about.
You loved it. You loved it. All right, go ahead.
I did. Yeah. So Resident Alien. So it the new season just came out. Season 3 came out in February. I started from the beginning. I had not even heard of it, but it is hilarious. So it is about an alien that crashes on our planet, and his goal was to kill off the human race, because we're just evil and his race wanted to get rid of us. So he comes down, he crashes, and he ended up taking over the body of this doctor. And I'm not going to give away, you know, all the things, but the wonderful part of this show is that as Dr. Van der Spiegel, which is he's impersonating Dr. Van der Spiegel, who he killed. he is, as he has taken over the body and is existing as a human, he starts to have human emotions and he starts to feel like a human. And it's hilarious because he has this inner monologue that where he kind of describes what he's feeling as he's feeling these new human emotions. And it's hilarious, touching, and just awesome. This show, I feel, has the same feel good quality as Ted Lasso.
It does like have that same good feel good quality. Yes.
And I mean, it goes really dark sometimes.
Sometimes Ted Lasso does.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it has that overall, like you're rooting for everybody in the show, which
including the guy who's killing the human. Yeah.
Yes.
You end up rooting for him because he's so darn likable.
He's so likable and hilarious and just, yeah. Yeah.
But I just love the perspectives you get.
Yes.
You know, seeing our world through those alien eyes is great.
Right. Yeah. And the things they're covering, like the concepts are just things that, you know, it's all about humanity. And that's the great thing about it is it's about this alien that, you know, really despises a human race. And it's watching the process of him falling in love with the human race.
Right. Yes.
And it's just, you know, it's
which
it's,
makes
it's,
us see now the best parts of ourselves.
Yes.
Yes.
Which brings us to his quote.
Okay.
My quote. So his quote was, and I can't remember what scene it was because I've been binging, so they're all blurring together, but this quote really resonated with me. So he said that he was taught as an alien, I was taught that the biggest problem with the human race was their need for connection, right? It made them weak. And he didn't say that, I'm saying that. We always saw this as a weakness, but now I realize it may be their greatest strength. And that really resonated with me, Joe, because I feel like it resonates with me as an accountant, right? We are number crunchers. That's how the public perceives us, as very dry number crunchers. We're relying on data and, you know, perfectionism, all that
stuff. We're also in the mind's eye, we're sitting in some dusty back room someplace all by ourselves.
With a visor on. Right.
Yes, with a visor on, with the door half closed, don't bother me.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the stereotype.
That's the stereotype. And so that's how our profession is perceived. And so what this reminds me of is that that's not who we are. In fact, that's not who we are, because what makes accountants so valuable and makes our industry so important is the connection that we have with our business clients. It's the connection. And that's the reason that technology will come and, you know, kind of take over the tasks that we do, the clinking on the keyboard and some of the calculations, but it will never, ever replace the connection we have with our clients, because that's the value that we're bringing to the world. And that's why we're all in this profession to begin with. And so this quote brought that home for me and really resonated with me.
Yep, absolutely. And then I would add to that connectivity with our peers too, which is a place we need to be so much more intentional about. But yes, good stuff. All right, so we're back to me now for the book of the month. You brought the topic, I'm bringing the book. I did not read this book in the last month, though I am working on two simultaneously that I'll be talking about in future podcasts. But this is one that I've read a little bit ago. I wanted to surface here, and it's called The Ideal Team Player, Patrick Lencioni. Again, if you've listened to one or two episodes of this, you've heard me say that if Patrick Lencioni wrote it, you need to read it. And this is just another example of that. This is one of his parabolic books. He tells a story. Story has a meaning. They're fun to read. They're great with Audible. But in this particular one, he's saying that that every team player can be broken into three different qualities. And the qualities are the team player that is hungry, the team player that is humble, and the team player that is smart. And by smart, they don't mean trade skill intellect. What they mean is people smart. So people smart, humble, hungry. Those are the three aspects of anybody in a corporate environment. Well, they don't live in silos most of the time. Usually they're a combination of two out of the three. And as he's dissecting these things, certain patterns emerge. For example, if somebody is people smart and hungry, you've got yourself a danger spot in the company. And he calls that the skillful politician. Right? And if somebody is humble and people smart, you've got a diplomat. Right? But if they're humble And anything without being hungry, you can also have somebody that isn't high performing. So they're just perfectly content with the sort of the energy of the room. So I'm not going to break about all the different combinations here, because when you start working on the exponential multiple, that could start getting blurred together as you're driving along in your car. Biggest takeaway is from this is the skillful politician, beware. So if you have somebody in your company that you know is hungry and people smart, but not very humble, that person, despite the fact that it may seem that they're getting along with everybody, and despite the fact that they may have convinced you, or that you may actually genuinely believe and see that they are one of the best people in your company for the goodness of the company, you may be, and other people in the company may be, being fooled. And just keep in mind that they may not even be aware of what they're doing. They're just such natural chess players. They may be manipulating the cords of humanity without even being aware they're doing so. And the last thing I will say on that is, if somebody is humble and any of the other two are not any of the other two, you have moldable clay. You could find what motivates a humble person to make them hungry. You can train a humble person to better understand the dynamics of human relationship. You could take a hungry person who's humble and teach them people skills. But the one thing you cannot do is you cannot teach humility. Now, Patrick Lencioni doesn't actually say this in the book in so many words, but this is Joe's 56 years of the Diploma of School of Hard Knocks and self-awareness. For 56 years, I have encountered the arrogant and the egotistical, the narcissistic. And though I have tried to coach and nurture and mentor those people into a position of humility, the only teacher of humility for the human race, the only one, is life itself. Mm. A human cannot teach another human humility. So
no, there you go. You're right. And you know, it's sad, because if you don't have humility, there's very little room for growth, right?
You won't even receive life's lesson, will you?
Exactly.
And not unless it hits you upside the head with a, you know, proverbial 2x4, then all of a sudden you'll wake up for a second. Right.
And it's funny, because if that happens to you, you don't even realize that you've just received the biggest gift you could possibly get. Right. Yes. So, yeah,
it's true.
Very it's deep, true. Joe.
Well, thanks to my friend, Patrick Lencioni. I feel like he's my friend because I've
read everything. Have you ever met him, Joe?
No, I never have.
You have to meet
him. They say don't meet your heroes, but I don't know. In this case, I think I do want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually thought about having him come to Scaly New Heights, but he's some unbelievable amount per hour. It's like, you know, almost $200,000 an hour or something last time I looked. So we'll leave that to people with deeper pockets, and I'll just keep reading the books. Yeah. All right. So we have favorite social posts of the week, and I'll let you lead out with your favorite one. Who wrote it? What did they say?
Jason Statz again. Yes, Jason. Clearly, I'm a Jason Statz fangirl.
That guy. Well, he does have a lot of good things to say.
I loved this. And actually, it goes along with a lot of what we've been talking about today, Joe, is that he says it's easier to work on your clients than it is to work on yourself. And that is the challenge, right? For me, it's easier to focus on task work and keeping my treadmill going. Not even sometimes, I would say all the time, than it is to stop and look at the big picture and am I being effective? Am I working, you know, am I working towards the VMP, towards the goals of my personal goals, the goals of the organization? And then having to step away to really push the needle towards the bigger picture. We don't do that because it's hard, and it causes us, we have to use humility when we're doing that, right? Because we have to take a look at, you know, what is going wrong. And what are the things that we have to do to fix it? And normally the things we have to do to fix it are things that are not easy, but they're the things that we really need to be putting the effort into. So I loved that because it really did hit home. I find myself that when I'm feeling really frustrated with something, I'll go and shift to working on, you know, task work, because if it's repetitive, I don't have to use a lot of brain power to do it. And it's those big things that are driving change and driving big outcomes that require more brain power. So I think that's one of the reasons we do it. And I think we tell ourselves that we're doing it because, you know, I have to work on billable stuff. I think that's what, as owners, firm owners, a lot of times we're like, well, I gotta be billable. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's the fact that sometimes we're walking around with, you know, like this, with, I'm covering my eyes for those of you who can't see me. you know, that we're walking around like that going because we're comfortable and we're complacent. And you have to shake that off if you're going to grow.
I could not agree more. And to complement what Heather is saying here, what Jason has said in his post, I would recommend that you watch a TED Talk. If you just search TED.com for the word procrastination, you will get Tim Urban's TED Talk, which I've talked about here in this podcast multiple times. He says the reason we do this is because we operate only from within a position of fear, neutralizing fear. So the what happens is we are afraid of the task that is larger, that is unpredictable, that isn't necessarily fun at the beginning, right? And that fear, that uncertainty, and that doubt, that FUD causes us not to act on the thing that is the longer term intentional project. And then then he makes a really good point in the TED Talk, that procrastination is not inaction, it is the wrong actions. So what we do is we fill up, we replace the fear of this big uncertain task with things that are certain and immediate and fun. And until a greater fear comes along, and that is the deadline-driven fear. So say, for example, that you're presenting a breakout session at Scaling New Heights. Well, you're not going to work on it until finally Heather says, if I don't have your deck by Friday, I'm going to have to give your spot up. Now, all of a sudden, there's a greater fear than your fear of failure. There's a greater fear than your fear of unknown, and that's the fear that I'm going to lose my breakout session. So you work through the night on the thing you should have worked on 2 months ago because the acute fear is replacing the background noise fear. And that was such a wake-up call for me because I realized that that's the human condition, is to bounce like a pinball between acute fear, long-term fear, acute fear, long-term fear, acute fear, long-term fear. And the most tragic thing that can happen, and this is a spoiler alert for the TED Talk, is when you don't have the deadline. Right. That's the book you never write. You know, that's the business you never start. You know, that's the hobby you never take up, because there's no acute fear to actually get you to act with intention. And that's what gets written on your gravestone. Here lies Joe Woodard, non-author of that book he didn't write. You know, right. I want to kind of sober everybody up.
No, you're right. And, you know, I think that, you know, you have to put yourself in a condition of constantly learning. And I think, you know, fear of missing out is still a fear. And so if you can get into the mindset of, I remember this, where this hit me with like a ton of bricks, Joe, was it was probably 15 years ago, maybe even longer than that. And I was taking the certification course for QuickBooks. This was before QuickBooks Online. It was QuickBooks Desktop. So that'll tell you how long ago it was. And Michelle Long was demonstrating the reclassified tool that's in QuickBooks Desktop. And I didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. And I was, and so I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is life-changing. And I was talking to somebody about it. It may have been Michelle. And I was like, yeah, I remember that, you know, I can't believe they just came out with this. This is great. And she's like, what are you talking about? This has been out here for 3 years.
Oh, wow.
And so all of a sudden I realized how much time I had not saved in the past 3 years by not knowing that that tool existed, because it had transformed how I worked and it saved me so much time and everything was so much better in the way that I did, you know, year-end cleanups, that I was like, I don't ever want to not know about that tool again. And so it really changed my perspective. So I do think that, you know, it's a mindset of keeping your finger on the pulse and staying in it and not just going into your, you know, your cave and putting that visor on, right? The accountant visor on and ignoring what's happening. So,
yeah. And I like what you mentioned about the FOMO piece, right? And then you've got sort of fear of loss piece, because until we can get to the point where determination and more positive motivators break us out of the cycle, which we all want, we can at least leverage the other fears to create intention, like fear, like the FOMO and the fear of missing and the fear of loss. So that's really good. As a matter of fact, you should send that to Tim Urban and go, hey, maybe this is like, you know,
yeah,
the vaccine for the drug of fear to kind of get you out of the pattern. Right.
Right.
I love that a lot. So my post was from a guy that I had never read before, that to my knowledge, and never quoted before. His name is Adrian Parker. I don't know him, but he posted something that really caught my eye. And he's a person of color. But even if he weren't, the truth is the truth of this. He says, your company doesn't have a diversity problem. Your company has made a diversity decision. Well, I want to take this and I want to extract it out beyond just the topic of DEI, because we could do an whole podcast on DEI, some of my thoughts about it, which are different than some of the other people's thoughts about it, you know. And I'm bigger on representation and belonging than I am on diversity. We could talk about all of that because it ends up at the same place. It's just, how do you get there? Right. But to his point, and his point is really good. Whether you say your company doesn't have a belonging problem and has a belonging decision, or a representation problem, is a representation decision, whatever the word is used, inclusion problem, inclusion decision, whatever the word you use or you emphasize here, the point of the post is that inaction is a form of action if it persists too long. That indecision is a form of decision if it persists too long. Again, back to Patrick Lencioni, he uncovers this in his book called The Advantage, where he talks about company values, which means company behaviors, not company ethics. And we talk about this a lot, Heather, at Woodard. We've adopted these principles. You can have something called an accidental behavior, and it's the behavior that you don't even realize that you've done. It's creeped in largely through inaction. And then all of a sudden you look around and this behavior is taking place in the company, and you're like, you don't even know where it came from. And so then you curtail an accidental behavior with something that is not quite operational yet. You got to work your way there. It's aspirational. So what do we aspire to change about our behaviors? And what I take away from Adrian's post is, if you look around your office and you're not representative of the larger community that you serve, then you probably have an accidental behavior. And I would encourage you to adopt an aspirational behavior, which doesn't mean turn right around and start hiring people on quotas. That's my beef with it. I have a Black daughter. I never want her to be somebody's checkbox. But it does mean create a plan of intentionality that starts with everybody feeling welcome, everybody belonging, and then work your way through representation. Then all of a sudden, watch.
Mm-hmm.
Watch how more people feel welcomed into your community and watch how that changes. And so you can use this with any topic, not just DEI. Watch for those accidental behaviors and turn them into aspirational ones to correct, which kind of is back to your quote from Jason.
Yeah, no, it is. And it absolutely. And really, this comes back to every time we start talking about this, I think about the quote that you say, or that you're always quoting, and I can't remember who it is that you're quoting. It says, proceed afraid.
Yes, right? That's John Maxwell.
John Maxwell. That is the key. You have to proceed afraid. And it's having courage. And, you know, that's our whole theme, right?
Or maybe you can boldly go. Yes, you and I are about to get there at the same time. Yeah.
But it's being courageous. It's being courageous. Yes. It's being honest with yourself, which is one of the most courageous things that you can do, right? Yes.
Is being honest with yourself.
And then, like you said, take action.
Coming up on Mark, and I know we've got the last topic.
This is
the one you always close out with. It's the Woodard Report podcast. You are the senior editor of the Woodard Report. What was your favorite article this past week?
So mine, I'm going to be a little biased here. I'm going to be a little biased. Sorry. So I'm really excited because my bestie, Liz Scott, is writing a series of articles on Copilot. So we've been talking a lot about
ChatGPT. This is Microsoft's Copilot, yes.
Yeah, Microsoft's Copilot. We've been talking a lot about ChatGPT. There's been a lot of articles, but Liz is doing a series of articles as she explores Copilot within the Microsoft ecosystem. So I'm really excited. She just kicked off her first article this week, and she'll be writing a series over the next month or so about what she's found and how she's using it in her practice and in her life. So I'm really excited about that.
Yep. And somebody on our team just thought it'd be fun to type my name into Copilot. And you saw this, and you saw this in tease, and it was accurate with the exception of one statement that I'm happily married to my wife, Karen. I'm not. My wife's name is Sandra, and that we're enjoying our 9 grandchildren. I hope I don't have 9 grandchildren. I have one 16-year-old daughter. If I have 9 grandchildren, I have a problem. So it's funny, but I kind of joke around with that too to say, okay, maybe part of what Liz is surfacing is always discern what it's telling you. It's not.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
When ChatGPT first came out, Liz and I asked it about Appy Hour, and I think I was a professor at one of the Ivy League schools, and I was like, okay, and we had written several books.
When I first did it with ChatGPT, it gave me credit for one of the books Jody Paydar wrote.
That's right.
So that was fun for Jody.
Yeah. You definitely have to fact check and, but we're living in such an exciting time.
It is an exciting time. And it's a child that's growing into adolescence that will be an adult soon. And when that happens, the whole world's going to open up.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been great. Heather, always have fun and looking forward to the next time.
All right. Take care, everybody. See you next time.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, please visit woodard.com/podcast.